All right, tonight I want to pick up where we left off in the book of Isaiah. We left off in chapter 23, and actually this is kind of going to conclude this section of Isaiah, where basically Isaiah has been pronouncing judgment after judgment after judgment against various nations and various cities. I mean, he pronounced judgments against the Philistines and against the Moabites, against the Edomites and against Egypt and against, in my opinion, it was even America in chapter 18 of Isaiah, and against Ethiopia and Babylon and Arabia. He's pronounced all these different judgments against all these different nations. And now he's going to pronounce a judgment against Tyre. Now, here's what's really significant about Tyre. Tyre was an extremely wealthy Phoenician city that became extremely wealthy because of her trade. In other words, it was a Phoenician city that just had a booming shipping industry where they would just ship stuff all over the world. They had this import-export going, and they just became extremely rich. And the very unfortunate thing is that money very often can blind people. I don't care whether it's individuals or nations or even churches or societies. They get to the point where when people's focus becomes that of material things and that of money, it's very, very easy to forget God. And God has a special judgment against the city of Tyre because they became so wealthy, they just felt like they didn't need God. Now, here's what's kind of interesting, too. If you look up on that map there, you can see Tyre way up there in the left-hand corner next to the Mediterranean Sea. But also above Tyre, you see the city of Sidon. Both of these were Phoenician cities. And Sidon was a Phoenician city that actually was in existence before Tyre. And a lot of their merchants went down to Tyre and they built a city down there. So it was almost like Sidon was the mother city of Tyre. And God has a tremendous judgment to pronounce against them. And before we even get into that, I think it's kind of significant because Jesus Christ mentions Tyre. And when he talked about it in the Gospel of Luke chapter 10, he also talked about it in Matthew chapter 11. When Jesus was rebuking the cities of his day that witnessed so much of what Jesus did in terms of his miracles and his healings and all of his teachings and everything that he did. And these people didn't repent. So this is what Jesus Christ said to these particular cities of his day. He said this, and he began to denounce the cities in which most of his miracles were done because they did not repent. He said, "Woe to you, Chorazin! Woe to you, Bethsaida! For if the miracles had occurred in Tyre and Sidon, which occurred in you, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. Nevertheless, I say to you, it will be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon in the day of judgment than for you. And you, Capernaum, will not be exalted to heaven, will you? You will descend to Hades, or to hell, for if the miracles had occurred in Sodom, which occurred in you, it would have remained to this day. Nevertheless, I say to you that it will be more tolerable in the land of Sodom in the day of judgment than for you." And I thought that's kind of interesting that Jesus made reference to the fact that Tyre underwent a tremendous judgment as a nation because they had forgotten God. And Jesus basically is saying on the day of judgment, it's going to be more tolerable for that particular city when they are judged before God and before this great white throne than it will be for the people of Capernaum and the people that of Jesus' generation who witnessed all the things that Jesus had done. So anyway, I just want to kind of preface that before we get into this pronouncement of judgment that Isaiah is making on Tyre. He says this in the beginning of verse 1 of chapter 23 of Isaiah. He says, "The oracle concerning Tyre, wail, O ships of Tarshish, for Tyre is destroyed. Without house or harbor, it is reported to them from the land of Cyprus. Be silent, you inhabitants of the coastland, you merchants of Sidon, you messengers crossed the sea and were on many waters. The grain of the Nile and the harvest of the river was her revenue, and she was the market of nations. Be ashamed, O Sidon, for the sea speaks, the stronghold of the sea, saying, I have neither travailed nor given birth. I have neither brought up young men nor reared virgins. When the report reaches Egypt, they will be in anguish at the report of Tyre. Pass over to Tarshish, wail, O inhabitants of the coastland. Is this your jubilant city whose origin is from antiquity, whose feet used to carry her to colonize distant places? Who has planned this against Tyre, the bestower of crowns? Whose merchants were princes, whose traders were the honored of the earth, the Lord of hosts has planned it, to defile the pride of all beauty, to despise all the honored of the earth. Overflow your land like the Nile, O daughter of Tarshish. There is no more restraint. He has stretched out his hand over the sea. He has made the kingdoms tremble. The Lord has given a command concerning Cana to demolish its strongholds. He has said, you shall exalt no more, O crushed virgin, daughter of Sidon. Arise, pass over to Cyprus, and even there you will find no rest. You know, before we go any further, I just want to back up and just kind of break some of this down. And we can see where God is coming from in terms of his contempt for this particular city. Because like I said, this city epitomized materialism. This city epitomized the love of money. And this city had forgotten God. They felt like, well, who needs God? This is why I think Jesus made this reference to the fact that it's easier for a camel to go through an eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Because what is it about riches that just make people forget God? What is it?
You have a lot of money, you don't have to rely on him, and you can get yourself busy with all that money.
Well, yeah, I mean, money has this tenacity to it that can very often turn our focus from God, because what happens is that we just begin to feel autonomous from God. We just feel like, hey man, I don't need to look to God in prayer about anything because I've got enough money to accomplish anything in my life. All right, to solve any problem, this type of thing. I mean, people really can get to that point, and nations can get to that point. As a matter of fact, go all the way back to Deuteronomy chapter 6. I always go back to that and refer back to that about how God had warned his people. He says, listen, when you get into your land that I'm going to give you, the promised land, he says, and you get all of these orchards and these vineyards and these fields, and you get all these houses and these cisterns, and you get all of this wealth and all this prosperity, he says, when you get all this stuff and your bellies are full, he said, man, be careful, be watchful, beware. He says, because then you'll forget me if you don't do one thing. Anybody remember what that one thing is that God said is the only antidote we have to keep from forgetting him when we get wealthy? What's the one thing he said that needs to be done? Nobody remembers?
Something about reading this book.
Oh, good. Yeah. I mean, that's what God said. It's in Deuteronomy chapter 6. He said this, these words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart, and you shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up, and you shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontals on your forehead, and you shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Then it shall come about when the Lord God brings you into the land which he swore to your fathers Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to give you, great and splendid cities which you did not build, and houses full of all good things which you did not fill, and hewn cisterns which you did not dig, and vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant, and you eat in their satisfied, he said this, then watch yourself that you do not forget the Lord who brought you up from the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Now, he's just basically saying, you know what? The only antidote that we have to forget God when we are wealthy, when we have money, when we are prosperous, when we have material things, is to read his word. Constantly study, read his word. We were to have, you know, scripture verses, he says, on a doorpost of your house. We'll be talking about God when you rise up, when you walk along the way, when you're eating your meals, when you eat. You know, this is the only way to keep from forgetting God when we are rich and fat and sassy. And this is what happened to Tyre, and God just pronounced an enormous judgment upon this city because of her arrogance once she became so wealthy because of her sea trade. And he said this, he said that first part of that, he says, whale of ships of Tarshish. Now Tarshish, it's believed strongly is Spain. All right, on the coast of Spain. So these ships are going all over the known world from Tyre in terms of their import-export industry. And it says, it is reported to them from the land of Cyprus. And of course, you can't see Cyprus on that map there, but it's out there in the Mediterranean Sea. It's north of Tyre and Sidon, but that was a commercial island. All of these places where they had all these harbors in which these ships would go back and forth and all this trade, they were all going to suffer because of the, yeah.
Is Malta one of those cities?
Yeah, but you can't see Malta on that map either. But it's not real close to Cyprus, but it's out there in the Mediterranean Sea. You can't see it on that map. All right, but that too, it's not mentioned here. Malta's not mentioned, but it's much smaller than Cyprus. But at the same token, these were islands that were used in a lot of this seafaring trade. But it says here in that verse 3, and were on many waters, the grain of the Nile, and the harvest of the river was her revenue, and she was the market of the nations. Okay, even Egypt, with all of her grain, was using Tyre, the ships of Tyre, to export a lot of her grain, her produce. And in verse 4 it says, "Be ashamed, O Sidon, for the sea speaks, the stronghold of the sea, saying, I have neither travailed nor given birth. I have neither brought up young men nor reared virgins." Now, what does that mean? Verse 4. Remember what I said when we started this chapter? Is that Sidon actually was the mother city of Tyre. It was Sidon that was the first Phoenician city, or the import-export city. But she basically gave birth to Tyre in the sense that a lot of her merchants went down there and opened up a harbor, opened up a seaport, and she became much greater than her mother city, Sidon. So when it's saying here, "Be ashamed, O Sidon, for the sea speaks, the stronghold of the sea, saying, I have neither travailed nor given birth, and neither I have brought up young men nor reared virgins." It's almost as though this city Tyre, which Sidon gave birth to, never even existed when God gets finished with her. So this is what he's talking about when he's talking about all these different merchants that are going to really feel the pinch of what's going to happen when God destroys this city. But he says this, if you just go over here to verse 10, he says, "Overflow your land like the Nile, O daughter of Tarshish. There is no more restraint. He has stretched out his hand over the sea. He has made the kingdoms tremble. The Lord has given a command concerning Cana to demolish his strongholds." Well, it's basically saying this, it's God that's behind his destruction, because he asked that. But, you know, look at that verse 7. "Is this your jubilant city, whose origin is from antiquity, whose feet used to carry to colonize distant places?" Well, this city was not only a very wealthy city, it was just filled with what? It was filled with the amusements, and it was filled with partying and celebrating, and one thing after another. It was just one big party island. But what did God say about this? He said that verse 8, "Who has planned this against Tyre, the bestower of crowns, whose merchants were princes and whose traders were the honor of the earth? The Lord of hosts has planned it to defile her beauty," all of her beauty. It was God who decided, you know, I'm going to put an end to this city, because this city has basically given me its collective middle finger, and they feel like they don't need me. Well, I'm going to destroy them. So when you look at this, look at that verse 12. "And he has said, you shall exalt no more, O crushed virgin daughter of Sidon. Arise, pass over to Cyprus. Even there you will find no rest." He says, "Behold the land of the Chaldeans. This is the people which was not. Assyria appointed it for desert creatures. They erected their siege towers. They stripped its palaces. They made it a ruin. Wail, O ships of Tarshish, for your stronghold is destroyed. Now in that day, Tyre will be forgotten for 70 years, like the days of one king. At the end of 70 years, it will happen to Tyre as in the song of the harlot. Take up your harp, walk about the city, O forgotten harlot. Pluck the string skillfully, sing many songs that you may be remembered. It will come about at the end of 70 years that the Lord will visit Tyre. Then she will go back to her harlot's wages and play the harlot with all the kingdoms of the face of the earth. Her gain and her harlot's wages will be set apart to the Lord. It will not be stored up nor hoarded, but her gain will become sufficient food and choice attire for those who dwell in the presence of the Lord." Now, what he's saying here, you go to that verse 13 and keep this in mind. This was written by Isaiah. He prophesied around 750 years before Christ. But what he's saying here is very, very profound in terms of his prediction, because in that verse 13, first of all, from verses 1 to 12, God is basically outlining his plan to destroy Tyre. But then in that verse 13, he's telling us how he's going to do it. Because in that verse 13, it says, "Behold the land of the Chaldeans." Now, who were the Chaldeans?
Babylonians.
He says, "This is a people which was not. Assyria appointed for desert creatures. They erected their siege towers. They stripped its palaces. They made it a ruin." Now, what does that mean? Well, when Isaiah was writing this, Assyria was the dominant world power at the time. And as far as Assyria was concerned, Babylon was nothing. It says here, Assyria appointed it for desert creatures. I mean, Babylon was nothing. It was not a threat to anyone or anything at this particular time when this prophecy was made. Assyria was the dominant world power. And if anybody had come up and said, you know what, Babylon is going to rise up and destroy Tyre, people would have laughed in their face, because it was like, Babylon's nothing. They're nothing. But they became the world dominant power. And guess what happened? before I go any further as far as explaining this, this is how Tyre is destroyed, because Ezekiel, he prophesied during the Babylonian captivity that he was in, but in chapter 26 and 27 of Ezekiel, you don't have to turn there, but this is what Ezekiel prophesied in regard to what was going to happen to Tyre. Because okay, in chapter 26 of Ezekiel, it says this: "Therefore, thus saith the Lord, behold, I am against you, O Tyre. I will bring up many nations against you as the sea brings up its waters. They will destroy the walls of Tyre and break down her towers, and I will scrape her debris from her and make her as bare as a rock. She will be a place for the spreading of the nets in the midst of the sea, for I have spoken, declares the Lord God. She will become a spoil for all the nations. Also her daughters who are on the mainland will be slain by the sword, and they will know that I am the Lord. For thus saith the Lord God, behold, I will bring upon Tyre from the north Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, king of kings, with horses and chariots and cavalries and a great army. And he will slay your daughters on the mainland with the sword, and he will make siege walls against you and cast up a ramp against you and raise up a large shield against you. The blow of his battering rams he will direct against your walls, and with his axes he will break down your towers, because of the multitudes of his horses. The dust raised by them will cover you. Your walls will shake at the noise of cavalry and wagons and chariots when he enters your gates as men enter a city that is breached. With the hoofs of his horses he will trample all of your streets, and he will slay your people with the sword and your strong pillars, and will come down to the ground. Also they will make a spoil of your riches and a prey of your merchandise, and break down your walls and destroy your pleasant houses, and throw your stones and your timbers and your debris into the water. So I will silence the sound of your songs, and the sound of your harps will be heard no more. I will make you a bare rock, and you will be a place for the spreading of the nets. You will be built no more, for I, the Lord, have spoken, declares the Lord." Now, you could read the entire chapter 26 of Ezekiel, because he deals with this event, and also the lament that is written in chapter 27 of Ezekiel. I don't have time to go through that, but here's one of the most amazing prophecies that was ever made in regards to Tyre, and basically what you would find in the Bible, and that's what Ezekiel predicted. You know what God said he was going to do? He said he's going to take that whole stinking city of Tyre, and he's going to throw it into the sea. He's going to scrape that whole city as bare as a rock, and throw them into the sea. It will become a place of the spreading of the nets. And this is what's very, very profound as far as this prophecy is concerned, is that what happened is we are told right here, we were just reading it in Isaiah and we read it in Ezekiel, where God was going to use the Babylonians. He was going to use Nebuchadnezzar to destroy this city. Now here's what's interesting, is that Nebuchadnezzar came down and he destroyed the southern kingdom of Israel or Judah around 586 BC. But around 580 BC is when Nebuchadnezzar went up to Tyre and he just completely demolished the mainland city. But the thing is, they had, as part of their city, they had this island that was about a quarter mile out from their mainland. And a lot of the people fled to that island, and Nebuchadnezzar didn't have any ships, so he couldn't go out to that island, but he completely demolished the main city right there on the mainland of Tyre. Completely demolished it. And he just left it in a heap of ruins. And of course he killed a lot of the people and enslaved a number of others, but a lot of people managed to escape, and they went off to that island. Well, God said, "I'm going to take this whole city and throw it into the sea." Well, what's interesting is that Nebuchadnezzar didn't have a navy, so he turned around and went down kicking the snot out of this nation and that nation and other nations, and he just left them be out there on that island. But when Alexander the Great was on his march about 200 years later or more, he came up to that island and he said, "Surrender to me," and they just blew him off. They figure, well, he doesn't have any ships, he can't get to us. And that so infuriated Alexander the Great that he had all of his army and all of his soldiers, all of his mercenaries, he had all of his slaves, he had all the people, the surrounding villages, take all that debris of that mainland city that Nebuchadnezzar had destroyed, and they threw it into the sea, and they built this causeway going right over to that island, and that's where Alexander the Great destroyed Tyre. Right? That's how he did it. And that's exactly what the prophets had foretold, that God would take that whole city and he'd throw it into the sea, and it would become a place of the spreading of the nets. And when you know what's kind of interesting? Today, that's all Tyre is. It's just a small little fishing village where they spread the nets. Now, that was a tremendous judgment that God pronounced upon this very, very wealthy, well-to-do independent nation that just felt like we don't need God. We're rich, we're famous, we're powerful, and everything else. And God just said, well, it's time for judgment. And so he just judged them, and that's how he judged the city of Tyre. Now, here's what, another interesting thing, when he says this, when you're reading this in Isaiah chapter 23, pick up with that verse 15. It says, now in that day, Tyre will be forgotten for 70 years, like the days of one king. At the end of 70 years, it will happen to Tyre as in the song of the harlot. Take up your harp, walk about the city, O forgotten harlot. Pluck the strings skillfully, sing many songs that you may be remembered. And it will come about at the end of 70 years that the Lord will visit Tyre. Then she will go back to her harlot's wages and play the harlot with all the kingdoms of the face of the earth. Now, what it's saying there is when Nebuchadnezzar had destroyed that city, that mainland city, totally and completely, it took 70 years for Tyre to get back on her feet on that island as far as her seafaring trade was concerned, but it never reached that kind of zenith that it had when they were one city as far as the mainland is concerned. But after 70 years, after Nebuchadnezzar had demolished it, they were basically back in business. But what happened to them? It says right here, then she would go back to her harlot's wages. What's that mean?
They just returned to the same kind of behavior of money and
trading. Yeah, because here's the thing. It's the harlot's wages. It's talking about the situation where if we put money before God, guess what we've just done? We have committed an act of immorality, spiritually speaking. It was Jesus who said, hey, listen, no man can serve two masters. You either love one or hate the other, cleave to one, despise the other. You cannot serve God and what?
Mammon,
which is wealth or money. You see, this is what people got to understand. See, when it talks about her going back to her harlot's wages, it means that, once again, she put money before God. But here's the thing. She never really reached that zenith that she once had before Nebuchadnezzar came by and destroyed the mainland. But she did get back up on her feet. She did become, you know, a seafaring nation again as far as her trade was concerned. But then Alexander the Great put an end to that. That's why Jesus is saying, amen, it's going to be more tolerable in a day of judgment for Tyre than it is for, you know, his generation. That's what he's talking about here. Now, there's going to be another Tyre in this respect. At the end of the world, there's going to be a major city that is going to epitomize trade and commerce and money and material things. It's going to be a concentration of the world's wealth and trade. Because when we went through the book of Revelation, we read about the religious whore that was described in Revelation chapter 17. God has a special judgment for this religious whore. All the basically the false religious systems of the world, all the sorcery, all the witchcraft, all the false religions, that's the religious whore. That's the whore that persecutes the true people of God. But then, in chapter 18, it talks about an economic whore that God has a special judgment for. And it appears that it's going to be concentrated right down there in Babylon, in Iraq. And I've said this many times over the years. It was Saddam Hussein, even though he's been long dead, he was the one that basically instituted having the city of Babylon rebuilt. Now, the whole city isn't completely rebuilt, but he's the one who basically resurrected that city. And apparently, from what the prophets foretell, that particular city is going to become the commercial hub of the world during the tribulation period. And interesting thing, this is what God said about this particular city. He said this, and the kings of the earth who committed acts of immorality and lived sensuously with her will weep and lament over her when they see the smoke of her burning. This city is going to go up in smoke. And three times it says in the book of Revelation chapter 18 that it happens in 1 hour. So what does that suggest to you is going to happen to this city? If the whole thing goes up in smoke in 1 hour, what do you think it's going to be?
Neutron bomb.
Most likely. No, it's most likely going to be a nuclear bomb. And it's not going to be a neutron bomb because everything's going to go up in smoke. Now, that's speculative. But, I mean, put it all together. But it says here, the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her. And I was just talking about over here in Isaiah chapter 23, where it talks about a harlot's wages. And over here it talks about kings of the earth who committed acts of immorality and lived sensuously with her will weep and lament over her. So what does that mean? if there's talks about the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality with her and lived sensuously with her, what does that mean?
That everybody was doing trade and in a sack with the Babylon.
Yeah, in other words, they put the money first. That's an act of spiritual immorality. That these people have committed an immoral act before God because they have put money in the place of God. And money, you know, they do anything to money. They lie, cheat, steal. But these guys, they're not the thugs out there in the gutter, man. These guys are the Wall Street guys with all their $2,000 suits. You know, it's like it says here, the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality with her. Then it goes on to say this. It says, they will weep and lament over her and see her smoke of her burning, standing at a distance because of the fear of her torment, saying, "Woe, woe, the great city, Babylon, the strong city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come. The merchants of the earth weep and mourn over her because in 1 hour her cargoes are no more. Cargoes of gold and of silver and precious stones and pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet and every kind of citron wood and every article of ivory and every article made of every costly wood and bronze and iron and marble and cinnamon and spice and incense and perfume and frankincense and wine and olive oil and fine flour and wheat and cattle and sheep and cargoes of horses and chariots and slaves and human lives. The fruit of you long for has gone up from you, and all things that were luxurious and splendid have passed away from you. Men will no longer find them. The merchants of these things who became rich from her will stand at a distance because of the fear of her torment, weeping and mourning." Now, why would they stand at a distance? Out of fear of her torment. Why are they standing at a distance?
Pretty powerful judgment going on.
Yeah, nuclear radiation and fallout. Yeah, right? And saying, "Woe, woe, the great city who has, she who was clothed with fine linen and purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, for in 1 hour with such great wealth has been laid waste, and every shipmaster and every passenger and sailor and as many as make their living by the sea stood at a distance and were crying out as they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, 'What city is like the great city?' And they threw dust on their heads, and they were crying and weeping and mourning, saying, 'Woe, woe, the great city which, in which all who had ships at sea became rich by her wealth, for in 1 hour is laid waste.'" Now, I'm not going to go any further on that, but you get the picture. I mean, this thing almost reads like a legal document. It's almost as though God doesn't want any loopholes here, that he wants it made abundantly clear that this whole materialistic system is going to go down. It's going to go up in smoke, and then it's going to be thrown into the sea like a big millstone. But you see, what God did to Tyre centuries ago, he has a special judgment for a new Tyre. Only this Tyre is referred to as Babylon, because it's going to become the commercial center of the world. But then, if you look at this last verse here in Isaiah chapter 23, he says this. As a matter of fact, let me read the last two verses.
John, you were in...
Yeah, I was in Revelation chapter 18. Now I'm coming back, because I was just going to say, there's another Tyre on the horizon. Only this Tyre is going to be referred to as Babylon, but the principle is the same, because both these cities epitomize the love of money and commercialism, and people will do anything for money, and they put money before God. So God has a special judgment for them. But in verse 17 and 18, last two verses of chapter 23 of Isaiah, it says this: "It will come about at the end of 70 years that the Lord will visit Tyre. Then she will go back to her harlot's wages and play the harlot with all the kings of the face of the earth." Like I said, after 70 years that Nebuchadnezzar had destroyed the mainland, they were back in business, but they never achieved what they once had in terms of all her wealth and popularity. However, it was Alexander the Great who finally did them in. But then he says in this verse 18, "Her gain and her harlot's wages will be set apart to the Lord. It will not be stored up or hoarded, but her gain will become sufficient food and choice attire for those who dwell in the presence of the Lord." Now, what does that mean? Anybody have any idea what he's talking about there? Well, you know what's kind of interesting to me? What I believe he's suggesting here, and I'm not going to read this whole Psalm 45, but if you went back to that Psalm 45, it actually talks about a song celebrating the king's marriage. And this king's marriage is really the marriage of Jesus Christ to his church. But what's interesting, it talks about how this is going to be a marriage basically made in heaven between Christ and his people. But what's interesting is when Christ sets up his millennial kingdom and you have this basically this wedding feast between God and his people. It says here in Psalm 45, it says, "Listen, O daughter, give attention and incline your ear. Forget your people and your father's house. Then the king will desire your beauty because he is your Lord. Bow down to him. The daughter of Tyre will come with a gift. The rich among the people will seek your favor." And what's suggested here to me is this. God is going to do away with Tyre. Well, I mean, he already did away with Tyre, and he's going to do away with Babylon. But Tyre is still in existence today. It's just a fishing village. But when Jesus Christ returns, it appears that during the millennial period, this city of Tyre will begin to flourish once again. Only this time, they're going to recognize Jesus Christ as being God. And any wealth that they do have, they're going to bring it down there and glorify God with it. That's what that verse 18 is saying. Because if you look at these prophets, it's truly amazing what they do. They are always talking about judgment, 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 judgment. But they, in the end, almost invariably, they will talk about a time when things are going to be restored, when Christ is going to be ruling and reigning, and he's going to be victorious. And that's what that verse 18 is pointing to, alluding to, that even though there's a tremendous judgment for Tyre, in the end, there's going to be a Tyre during Jesus' reign. And like I said, Tyre is in existence today. It's just a fishing village. But it will apparently come back into prominence in terms of being very, very wealthy. But this time, they got their priorities right. This time, they're going to be glorifying God with their money instead of ripping their fellow man off or just, you know, forgetting God or flipping him off because they feel like, who needs God? Anybody have anything you want to add to, or share to that chapter 23 of Isaiah? Well, listen, I want to quickly go through this chapter 24, and I think it's going to be easy reading, but it does go into quite some detail, because now God is talking about the end of the world. Now he's talking about the destruction that's going to come upon this planet, and I think it's one of the most powerful chapters in the Bible. This chapter 24 of Isaiah, it goes hand in glove with chapter 24 of Matthew, when Jesus talks about the end of the world and his second coming, when he says this: "Behold, the Lord lays waste the earth, devastates it, and distorts its surface, and scatters its inhabitants. The people will be like the priest, and a servant like its master, and a maid like her mistress, and a buyer like the seller, and a lender like the borrower, and a creditor like the debtor. The earth will be completely laid waste and completely despoiled, for the Lord has spoken this word. The earth mourns and withers, the world fades and withers, the exalted of the people of the earth will fade away." Now, before we go any further, that's what I'm saying. Now Isaiah is jumping to the end of the world. Now that he's dealt with all these different nations as far as their specific judgments, now he's going to deal with the end of the world. And at the end of the world, this is what is going to happen. Just prior to Jesus Christ's return, it says, "Behold, the Lord lays the earth waste, devastates it, distorts its surface, and scatters its inhabitants." This verse 1, I'm going to tie it in with verses 20 and 21 when we get to those verses. But he's talking about how this world is going to completely be devastated and destroyed. And when he says in that verse 2, the people will be like the priest, the servant like the master, the maid like her mistress, the buyer like the seller, and the lender like the borrower, and the creditor like the debtor, what does that mean?
It doesn't mean what class or status you have. It's going to be the same for everyone.
Good.
All going to have nothing.
Good. Nobody's going to escape. It doesn't matter how rich and powerful, how famous you are, how much wealth you have. It doesn't matter if you're a Hollywood star, if you're a politician, it doesn't matter. This experience is going to be felt like by everybody. Nobody's going to escape what's coming. And he says here in verse 3, "The earth will be completely laid waste and completely despoiled, for the Lord has spoken his word." Now, this has never happened. This is a future date. It'll be completely laid waste. Well, what's going to happen at the end of the world? What's interesting to me, you go back to the writings of Exodus or the book of Exodus, and we read there the 10 plagues that God brought upon Egypt to destroy Egypt. I mean, what did he bring? He turned the Nile into blood, and he brought an infestation of billions of frogs upon the land. And then there was gnats, and then he brought flies. And then he brought the cattle were died by disease. And then he brought the boils upon the people. And then he brought hail mixed with fire. And then he brought an infestation of locusts, the likes of which the world had never seen before, nor would ever see again. And then he brought 3 days of darkness, and then finally the death of the firstborn that he brought upon Egypt. And we're going to see the exact same thing happen at the end of the world. These plagues are going to be global. These plagues are going to be worldwide, because instead of the Nile just turning to blood the way it was in Egypt, we read where the entire sea is going to turn to the blood of a dead man, or something like the blood of a dead man, where everything in the sea is going to die and all the fresh water is going to be turned to blood. And what's interesting too is that we are told that demons that look like frogs are going to go forth, and they're going to instigate this war of Armageddon. And also, there's going to be pestilence like you won't believe, and diseases that you won't believe. And also, there's going to be, well, the flies that came upon Egypt. What does Beelzebub mean?
Lord of the flies.
Lord of the flies. So you can make that spiritual application at the end of the world, that all the demons in hell are going to be let loose. I mean, they're going to be like flies. And the animals will suffer. We read that in the book of Joel. How they're going to suffer tremendously during this 7-year tribulation period. And also there's going to be sores on those who take the mark, and there's going to be 100-pound hailstones. Just like in Egypt, they had hailstones that were mixed with fire. Well, I believe that through nuclear blasts, when you have all that tremendous heat that's just thrown up into the atmosphere after a blast, and you see that mushroom cloud, and then it collides with all of that cold air in the stratosphere, especially if the sun has gone out, and then you see a situation where once that hot air collides with all that freezing cold air, it's going to come down in huge chunks of ice. And John says there's going to be 100-pound hailstones. It's going to pulverize the earth. And then you're going to see a situation where you're going to see demons that look like locusts, or they're going to be like locusts. They're going to come out of hell, and they're going to torment men for 5 months, and they're also going to be used to drive men down there to Israel for the last battle of the world. And then you're going to have darkness that's going to engulf the planet. You've got about at least a dozen times of scripture where Jesus Christ, the apostles, the prophets foretell that our sun is going to go out. And then we're not told how long it's going to last, but if it lasted for 3 days during the time of Moses, 3 days of darkness, then I believe it's going to be 3 days of darkness at the end of the world, just prior to Jesus Christ coming. And
well,
then
people live through that.
Well, they can't live through that, because Jesus Christ himself said, unless I come back and put an end to this, nobody's going to survive this. And I'd say,
I'm just wondering, if the sun goes out, would
right,
they freeze to death?
Right, but here's the thing. Go back to Revelation chapter 16. You see a situation where the angel pours out his vial or his bowl upon the sun, and it scorches men with intense heat. These judgments are consecutive, one right after the other. One pours his bowl upon the sun, and then it says, as it scorches men with intense heat. The other one scorches his bowl upon the kingdom of the Antichrist, and it is darkened. What's the kingdom of the Antichrist?
The earth.
The world. Put it all together. The temperatures of the earth are going to rise dramatically. People are going to be cursing God because of the heat. But now, where does a lot of our heat come from that keeps us warm? It's actually from the earth itself. Once the sun has warmed the earth, then the earth retains that heat. So what I'm saying is, simply because the sun goes out doesn't mean everybody's going to die in a second. Because you'll still have a situation where the heat of the earth will be cooling down rapidly, but still people will be able to survive. But they're not going to survive much more than 3 days after it's gone out. You see what I'm saying?
Coal miner is going to be your best friend.
Well, all I'm saying is, you put all this stuff together and you can see where this is all headed. Because, and of course the 10th plague was when God destroyed the firstborn. And then if you read, we read in the 13th chapter of Isaiah about how God is going to make men scarcer than pure gold, that he's going to destroy the sinners from the earth. And then you go back here to chapter 24 of Isaiah, where it says in verse 4, it says, the earth mourns and withers, the world fades and withers, and the exalted of the people of the earth fade away. You know, all these fat cats, all these people, they're all dying. He says, the earth is also polluted by its inhabitants, for they transgressed the laws, violated statutes, and broke the everlasting covenant. That's why God's going to bring this judgment, is because men have transgressed his laws and violated his statutes and broke the everlasting covenant. And they have just flipped God off, and God is going to bring this tremendous judgment upon them. And verse 6, it says, therefore, a curse devours the earth, and those who live in it are held guilty. Therefore, the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men are left. So what would that suggest to you if the inhabitants of the earth are burned? What does that suggest to you? They're burned with nuclear destruction. That's what he's referring to. All of these prophets have talked about and foretold all of this. As a matter of fact, in Peter, he talks about how the elements will melt with intense heat, and how everything is going to be burned up. And in the book of Zephaniah, it says this, It says, near is the great day of the Lord, near and coming very quickly. Listen, the day of the Lord. In it the warrior cries out, the day of wrath is that day, a day of trouble and distress, a day of destruction and desolation, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and thick darkness, a day of trumpet and battle cry against the fortified cities and the high corner towers. I will bring distress upon men so that they will walk like the blind. They'll walk like the blind. Why? Everything's gone out. The sun's gone out. He says, I will bring distress upon men so they walk like the blind because they have sinned against the Lord, and their blood will be poured out like dust and their flesh like dung, and neither their silver nor their gold will be able to deliver them on the day of the Lord's wrath, and all the earth will be devoured in the fire of his jealousy, and he will make a complete end, indeed a terrifying one, to all the inhabitants of the earth. That's Zephaniah chapter 1. He's talking about the end of the world. And we read earlier in the chapter 2 of Isaiah where basically Isaiah says when Christ is returning that people who, you know, they're going to be trying to hide in the clefts of the rocks and the caves and the hills and bomb shelters and everything from Jesus Christ, and they're going to be throwing their gold and their silver to the bats and to the moles, and they're going to be crying to the mountains and the hills to fall upon them and crush them into oblivion because they're going to be so terrified when they see Christ coming. But of course those people who have given their life to Christ and have survived this horrible 7-year tribulation period, they're going to have tears of joy streaming down their faces, and they're going to be absolutely ecstatic to see Jesus Christ coming. But that's what he's talking about here. And at verse 7 of Isaiah chapter 24 says, and the new wine mourns, the vine decays, all merry-hearted sigh. The gaiety of tambourine ceases, the noise of revelers stops, the gaiety of harps ceases. They do not drink wine with song. Strong drink is bitter to those who drink it. The city of chaos is broken down, and every house is shut up so that none may enter it. Now, before we go any further here, he's just talking about how the new wine mourns and how all the merry-hearted sighs and all that other stuff that he's talking about here, there's going to be no joy on the earth. All right? There's going to be no partying. An interesting thing, in Psalm 104, it says this. He says that God causes the grass to grow for the cattle, the vegetation for the labor of man, so that man may bring forth food from the earth. And it says this, and wine which makes man's heart glad, so that he may make his face glisten with oil, and food which sustains his heart. In other words, God is saying here that God has given men wine to celebrate with. What God's saying here, man, the new wine mourns, the vine decays, all merry-hearted sighs. I mean, because people have put partying and feasting, all this type of stuff before God, all this is coming to an end at the end of the world. And in verse 11 it says,
the new wine mourns because it's not going to have a chance to become old wine.
Right down from the production of the grapes all the way to the fermentation of the wine, there's going to be nothing. Nothing. Strong drink's gone. It says here, strong drink is bitter to those who drink it. In other words, they're going to find no escape here in a bottle. And verse 11, there is an outcry in the streets concerning the wine. All joy turns to gloom. The gaiety of the earth is banished. Now, people think I'm just a big pessimist. You know, they call me Mr. Puddleglum, the pastor of disaster and all this. I'm looking at this and say, you know what? I didn't write one word of this. Not one word of it. You talk about pessimism. You talk about, you know, negativity. Well, just read it. That's what God says is coming upon this world because of unrepentant sinners. And verse 12 it says, desolation is left in the city and the gate is battered to ruins. The gate's battered to ruins. There's no defense against any of this coming. And verse 13, for thus it will be in the midst of the earth among the peoples as the shaking of an olive tree, as the gleaning when the grape harvest is over. They raise their voices, they shout for joy, they cry out from the west concerning the majesty of the Lord. In other words, when you're talking about in this verse 13 here, thus it will be in the midst of the earth among the peoples as the shaking of an olive tree, as the gleaning when the grape harvest is left. He's talking about how everybody's going to feel the effect of this. Everybody. All right? There's going to be no one who's not going to be affected by what's coming. And then it says this. You tell me what this is saying. Verse 14 and 15. And 16, it says, they raise their voices, they shout for joy, they cry out from the west concerning the majesty of the Lord. Therefore, glorify the Lord in the east, the name of the Lord, the God of Israel, in the coastlands of the sea. From the ends of the earth, we hear songs, glory to the righteous one. But I say, woe to me, for alas for me, the treacherous deal treacherously, and the treacherous deal very treacherously. Now, what does that mean? In verse 14 and 15, it's talking about at the very end, you're going to see Jesus Christ returning. Look at that verse 14. They raise their voices, they shout for joy, they cry out from the west concerning the majesty of the Lord. What direction is Jesus Christ coming from when he returns? He's coming from the east. He said he's coming from the east, as far like the lightning flashes from the east to the west. That's where he's coming from, the east. But the people in the west are going to see him coming. And in verse 15, therefore glorify the Lord in the east, the name of the Lord God of Israel, in the coastlands of the sea. All right, but look at verse 14. They raise their voices, they shout for joy, they cry out from the west concerning the majesty of the Lord when they see him coming in great power, great glory. And then it says, verse 16, from the ends of the earth we hear song, glory to the righteous one. But I say, woe to me, blasphemy, the treacherous deal treacherously, and the treacherous deal very treacherously. What does that mean?
Going from bad to worse.
Still evil abounds.
What that? Still the evil ones on the earth that are not happy to see him.
Right. In the very last book of the Bible, the last chapter of the Bible, God said this. He says, let the one who does wrong still do wrong, and the one who is filthy still be filthy, and let the one who is righteous still practice righteousness, and the one who is holy still keep himself holy. You would think it would say, it says here, let the one who does wrong still do wrong. But you would think it would say, let the one who does wrong begin to do right. And it says, the one who is filthy still be filthy. You would think it says, the one who is filthy to be cleansed of his filthiness. No. You see, there's coming a day when Jesus Christ is returning. People's destinies are fixed. Either you're saved or you're lost. And when people see Christ coming, of course, they're going to even act more treacherously. They're going to turn against Christ themselves.
That's because they would have taken the mark of the beast, I would assume.
Right.
And those that didn't, or the pure ones, those that took the mark of the beast are damned.
Right. But
even though they're still alive.
What's going to be their last act of treachery? That's absolutely insane.
Turning their guns on Christ.
Right, exactly. That's what I'm saying here. But what he says, but I say, woe to me, blasphemy, the treacherous deal treacherously, and the treacherous deals very treacherously. The last act of treachery or treason is they're going to turn their guns on Jesus Christ when they see him coming, and they're going to start firing on him. We're told that in Revelation. They make war against him who sits upon this white horse, and he just, with his word, John refers to it as a sword that comes out of his mouth. He expunges every last drop of blood out of the veins of all of these armies down there in Armageddon. And, their blood flows for 200 miles, the height of a horse's bridle. I mean, this is going to be absolutely gruesome when he comes back. And so when he says this in that verse 17 of Isaiah chapter 24, terror and pit and snare confront you, inhabitants of the earth. This isn't a local thing. This is global, right? Terror and pit and snare confront you, inhabiting the earth. Then it will be that he who flees the report of disaster will fall into a pit, and he who climbs out of the pit will be caught in a snare. For the windows above are opened, and the foundation of the earth shake. Now, what does that mean?
There's not going to be anywhere to go.
Yeah, there's no hiding. Everywhere you go, you're going to run into disaster everywhere. And then, look what he says here. That latter part of that verse 18, it says, for the windows above are open, and the foundation of the earth shake, and the earth is broken asunder. The earth is split through. The earth is shaken violently. The earth reels to and fro like a drunkard, and it totters like a shack, for its transgression is heavy upon it, and it will fall and never rise again. And so it will happen in that day that the Lord will punish the host of heaven on high and the kings on the earth, and they will be gathered together like prisoners in a dungeon, and will be confined in prison, and after many days they will be punished. Then the moon will be abashed and the sun ashamed, for the Lord of hosts will reign in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem, and his glory will be before his elders. Now listen to this powerful. It says here that the earth is broken asunder, the earth is split through, the earth is shaken violently, the earth reels to and fro like a drunkard, and it totters like a shack, for its transgression is heavy upon it, and it will fall and never rise again. And you go back to that verse 1 of this chapter, it says, behold, the Lord lays the earth waste, devastates it, distorts its surface, and scatters its inhabitants. And now get this picture. This is my take on it. This is speculative, but I bet every penny I have this is what's going to happen. The sun explodes at novas. And the reason I say that is because when we read further on in the book of Revelation or Isaiah, it says there's coming a time when the sun will be seven times brighter and the moon will become seven times brighter. So if that happens in this explosion, then what it says to me is this. It's the gravitational pull of the sun that keeps the Earth in its orbital path around the sun. The Earth is spinning at 1,000 miles an hour on its axis, and it's spinning through space at 67,000 miles an hour. It's not dead weight. So if the gravitational pull of the sun is completely altered, then what's going to happen? Our Earth right here, it's going to be broken asunder. The Earth is going to split through. The Earth is shaken violently. The Earth reels to and fro like a drunkard. In other words, it's going to start swaying. And because this whole crust of the Earth, it floats on these tectonic plates, these are all going to be shifting. These are all going to be moving, and everything's going to be coming down. Everything in the world's coming down in the shaking. Everything that man has built is going to come down because of this massive earthquake that I believe is going to be caused by our sun. And so when you read the latter part of that, verse 21, it says, "So it will happen in that day the Lord will punish the host of heaven on high and the kings on the earth of the earth." Now, what does that mean? So it will happen in that day the Lord will punish the host of heaven on high and the kings of the earth on the earth. What does that mean?
Fallen angels, I guess.
Good.
And,
good.
Rulers and
because,
politicians and all of the...
Good. Because just like what God did to Egypt, He not only judged the Egyptians, He judged all their gods. When the Lord went through and judged Egypt... And here it says it will happen in that day the Lord will punish the host of heaven on high. He's going to judge all these demonic forces, and the devil himself is going to be bound for 1,000 years, and all the demonic spirits are going to be bound for 1,000 years. But also, like Tom said, it also could apply to those who are in authority, because the Bible says we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but all these spiritual forces of wickedness that are in heavenly places, meaning high places, not just spiritual places, but on the earth, high places as far as power and influence and prestige. And then it says in verse 22, and they will be gathered together like prisoners in a dungeon and be confined in prison, and after many days they will be punished. What's that mean? Well, they're going to be confined to the prison. They're going to be confined to hell. But what's their final destination? Where it says
after
here,
after 1,000 years, they get judged and they get thrown into hell.
Not hell,
lake of fire,
lake of fire,
oh, yeah,
which is separate from hell. Okay. Where hell, all the damned souls are in hell, all the demonic spirits in hell, and death itself are going to be thrown into the lake of fire. So that's what it says. After many days, they will be punished. That's their final destination, is the lake of fire. And verse 23, then the moon will be abashed and the sun will be ashamed, for the Lord of hosts will reign on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem, and his glory will be before his elders. Now, the moon is going to be abashed and the sun ashamed. Well, it's talking about how the sun is going to go out. The moon will be turned blood red. In my opinion, it's going to be turned blood red, because if our sun explodes and you got all this radiation and all this debris from an exploded sun, it's probably going to make the sun, make the moon look red. But also, I believe, because the earth is going to be on fire from nuclear destruction, there's going to be a reflection that's going to show up on the moon. It's going to look red, in my opinion. But also, this is the application too. In verse 23, then the moon will be abashed and the sun ashamed, for the Lord of hosts will reign on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem. In other words, Christ's glory is going to be so magnificent that it's going to dwarf the light of the sun and the moon. That's what it's talking about. And his glory will be before his elders. All right? That people will see his glory when he returns. Now, I know we've covered a lot of ground there, but this chapter 24 of Isaiah, we could spend months in it. There's just no doubt about it. We could. But I just skimmed the surface, and I just said it goes hand in glove with Matthew 24, the end of the world, Revelations. Anybody have anyone to add or share?
Well, when they said that they broke the everlasting covenant, what do they mean by that?
Well, what's the everlasting covenant? Remember Jesus Christ, when he was the night before he died, he says that he broke the bread and he gave the wine. And he says, this is the new and everlasting covenant, the shedding of my blood. Well, people have despised Christ. They broke that covenant. The everlasting covenant is Jesus Christ shed blood.